We hear a lot about globalization, but what does it really mean for the lives of people? A filmmaker tells what's happening on the ground in Cambodia.
How do I support my family when the source of livelihood, when my source of livelihood, the land that I used to grow my rice on, the water that I used to fish my fish from, is being fished to extinction, or the land has been, you know, taken from me. You know, so that's really the general context of the film. But the families that, you know, tell these stories of their individual lives are really talking intimately about their own personal stories and how they're impacted by what is happening in Cambodia right now.
That's Kalyani Mam. We talked to her about her powerful award-winning film, A River Changes Course. And later, we talk about terroir, American terroir, in a replay of my interview last year with Rowan Jacobson. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In 1950, the UN General Assembly proclaimed the 10th of December as Human Rights Day. The International Declaration of Human Rights covers a lot of ground, and over the years, the rights have been extended to include those of children, the right to safe and healthy work conditions, and the right to a standard of living adequate for health and well-being. My guest, filmmaker Kalyani Mam, turns her lens on how these basic human rights are being eroded in the country of her birth, Cambodia. Her award-winning film, A River Changes Course, is an intimate look at the rapid changes and hard choices forced by globalization in that land, a place once of towering forests, pristine lakes and rivers, and fertile farms. She follows three young people, the fisherman Sari Mat, who lost his livelihood when the fish disappeared, Kyu Mok, who leaves her farm to work in Phnom Penh's garment factories, and Sav Samorn, an indigenous woman who is losing the native forest on which she depends to multinational companies who are cutting it down. A River Changes Course has won multiple awards, including the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival. Kalyani Mam was born during the Khmer Rouge regime and fled with her family in 1979. She lived in refugee camps for a while and then came to the U.S. when she was only 4 years old. She went back to Cambodia for the first time in 1998. I spoke to her in September. Kalyani Mam, welcome to Writer's Voice. A River Changes Course is a beautiful film. It's about profound changes that are happening to the rural people in Cambodia who are finding that their traditions are being threatened. You follow three families, but first, tell us about the changes that are happening in Cambodia.
So I follow three families living in distinct parts of the country, in the northeastern part of Cambodia, in the forests, in the jungles, on the lakes and the rivers, and in the countryside, and the women who are migrating, you know, from the village, you know, to the factories in the city to work. But the larger context, you know, is that, you know, all of these things are happening in Cambodia that are threatening, you know, people's lives and livelihood, not only their traditions, but their way of life and, you know, their ability to provide and care for their families. I was actually in Cambodia recently to document, you know, Cambodia's national elections. And I saw the people there protesting. You know, they were protesting and chanting, change, change, change. And they were all garment factory workers, tuk-tuk drivers, you know, moped taxi drivers. You know, people who were working in the marginalized economies, and, you know, they are struggling right now. You know, people are protesting at this very moment. You know, there are people who have lost their lives protesting against the government and protesting against the results of the national elections, you know, because the elections hasn't achieved the change that they wanted. You know, and people would not be protesting if they didn't have anything to lose. And this is the context of the film, you know, that people do not have anything to lose at this time. You know, they've been thrown off their land, you know, like the family, you know, in the film, Sav Samorn, you know, she lives in the jungles, you know, she belongs to one of 24 indigenous groups that live in Cambodia today and that depend on the forests and the land for their survival. You know, and many families living in the jungles and the forests, many indigenous groups have already been thrown off their land and thrown out of their forests, their forests cut down and replaced with industrial agricultural crops like rubber, you know, cassava, sugar, soy. And then the family that is living on the lakes and the rivers, you know, they are also being displaced as well, you know, because their lakes and rivers are being fished to extinction. Hydroelectric dams are being built, you know, are planning to be built all along the Mekong River, which will affect, you know, the fish population in the rivers. And so they are struggling as well to, you know, to make ends meet. You know, then Kyo, you know, actually when I was back documenting the elections, I followed Kyo back to her village as she placed her vote in the ballot box. And I asked Kyo, you know, what do you want for yourself? What do you want for your family? And she told me, you know, the only thing I want is a livable wage, you know, because right now I can't survive on $61 a month, which is what she was making when I was filming her. And I can't even survive on $80 a month, which is what she was making, you know, when I saw her. They had just risen, you know, raised the minimum wage to $80 a month a few months, you know, before the elections. And she can't survive on that. You know, she can't afford to buy food. She can't afford to, you know, pay her electric bill, her rent, you know, her water bill, and she can't afford to save enough money to send back to her family at home. And so everybody in Cambodia is struggling with those same questions. You know, how do I provide for my family? How do I support my family, you know, on the money that I'm making right now? But also, how do I support my family when the source of livelihood, when my source of livelihood, the lands that I use to grow my rice on, the water that I use to fish my fish from, is being fished to extinction, or the land has been, you know, taken from me? You know, so that's really the general context of the film. But the families that, you know, tell these stories of their individual lives, you know, are really talking intimately about their own personal stories and how they're impacted by what is happening in Cambodia right now.
You started filmmaking in 2008. Tell us more about the three families you follow in the film. How did you meet them?
So, Sidi, I first met in 2008. And, you know, that's when I decided that I wanted to make a film about, you know, the current struggles of Cambodian people right now. And, you know, just to give you a little context, I'm from Cambodia. I was born in Cambodia during the Khmer Rouge regime. And my family and I fled the country in 1979 after the Khmer Rouge fell from power. We lived in the refugee camps for a few years, and then we finally immigrated to the United States as refugees when I was 4 years old. You know, but growing up, I always, you know, had the passion, you know, to understand my country and understand where I came from. And, you know, I finally made it back to my country, my homeland, in 1998 to document the endurance of the Cambodian family during the Khmer Rouge period, you know, for my senior thesis. And, you know, when I traveled to Cambodia in 1998, you know, I saw this really beautiful country. You know, I saw this, you know, country filled with forests, you know, filled with natural resources. And I also saw beautiful people, you know, living their lives. They were struggling, of course, you know, but at least they had land and at least they had their forests. But in 2008, when I went back to Cambodia, you know, 10 years later, I saw a completely different country. You know, I saw that all the forests that were covered, you know, the country before was completely, you know, cut down, you know, and the rivers were being fished to extinction and all these factories were being built, you know, in Phnom Penh, you know, and I'm not against, you know, development at all. I'm not against globalization, but you always wonder, you know, when something happens, you know, what are the consequences, you know, how do these things impact, you know, people's lives? You know, and so I asked that question. I wanted to answer it, and I wanted to find out, you know, how you know, deforestation, how the cutting of forests, the removal of people from their land, you know, the overfishing in the waters, and the migration of women from the village, you know, to the city, you know, how this was impacting people's lives and also how it was impacting the environment. So in 2008, I went to a floating village in Kampong Chinang, and I found Siddhi in that village. And when I met Siddhi for the first time, he was only 14 years old. He was actually not 15, like, you know, he said in the film. He was only 14 years old, and he was so hopeful. You know, he was, you know, like any 14-year-old, really hopeful about the future, and he wanted to study. You know, he wanted to get an education. He wanted to provide for his family, something I've never heard of before from a 14-year-old in my life. You know, you never hear that in the United States, but this boy wanted to do that. And I wondered, you know, in the next few years, would he be able to do that? You know, is this possible for him?
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with filmmaker Kalyani Mam about her award-winning film, A River Changes Course. It was a very telling moment in the film, and it's the only time when you have a presence. It's very sensitively done. There's no narrative or voiceover in the film, but in that point, you ask him a question.
Yes. Yeah, I asked him, you know, do you remember when we first met? And he said, I do remember. And he described, you know, very vividly, you know, how we met and how he took me on a boat and we rowed out into the middle of the lake and we were searching for water hyacinth blossoms because I love flowers. And then he told me the story of his life. And then I asked him, so what did you tell me? You know, what were your hopes and dreams at that time? And he refused to answer me. You know, he just laughed and shirked, you know, the question, and he didn't tell me. You know, but then at that moment, you know, I revealed, you know, what he said through some, you know, the footage that we took at that time when he was 14. And what he said was, you know, that he wanted to get an education and provide for his family. And he was really, you know, he didn't want to tell me that. And the reason was because, you know, his life had changed so dramatically. I was filming him on a lake, on the river, you know, where in a floating village where he lived when he was 14 years old. This was his life. At 17, I was filming him on a Chinese cassava plantation. And he was working as a laborer for a Chinese cassava plantation. And he felt so ashamed. You know, at that moment, I think he felt so ashamed that he didn't follow through with his dreams, that, you know, it didn't work out, that he wasn't able to continue to go to school and get a job and provide for his families. And I think he just, you know, he felt really, I don't know if it was ashamed, but he felt really uncertain at that moment. And, you know, all of a sudden, he wasn't no longer a boy, you know, he was a young man. And looking back on his life.
It's a very powerful moment. Tell us about these cassava plantations. What are the conditions? He says he feels like a slave.
Yes, yeah. And that moment he also talks about, you know, being a slave to the Chinese and, you know, which echoed, you know, what his father said as well, you know, that's their future. You know, that with all the fish being fished to extinction, with all the fish gone from the rivers and the lakes, and them unable to support their families, you know, with their original livelihood, everyone will be forced to go and work as a slave, you know, for the Chinese. You know, and so on the cassava plantation, you know, where so they worked, you know, many of the villagers from his village actually went to work with him there too. And that's how they do it. You know, they follow one another. You know, one person goes and says, oh, this is great. You know, we can make $25 a month. You know, let's come. You know, and then they go and they follow one another. But the conditions, I mean, Siddhi, you know, he digs ditches every day. You know, that's what he says. You know, he digs ditches, you know, for the cassava. And the cassava, it's not the kind of cassava that you can eat. You know, it's actually cassava that is being exported to back to China and converted into ethanol.
So all these plantations,
these crops, these industrial agricultural crops that are being planted in Cambodia, like rubber, cassava, sugar, soy, they're not being consumed within the country. You know, they're being exported abroad for consumption elsewhere. And the land that once used to be farmland, that once used, that you know, supported families, you know, that sustained families, once used to be forests that supported families and sustained families, are now industrial agricultural crops that are not supporting families and sustaining families, but are being shipped abroad, you know, for consumption abroad.
Now, how is this impacting village traditions and family relationships? In the film, you see a father plaiting a basket that's so beautiful, and you wonder, what's going to happen to the family life in the village?
Yes, Francesca, that's a really wonderful question. I mean, that's exactly the reason why I decided to follow these particular families, because, you know, the indigenous people, you know, living, who depend on the forests for their livelihood, you know, and, you know, the father in the jungles, you know, he was plaiting these baskets, but the baskets are made of bamboo, and the bamboo come from the forests. You know, I actually went into the forest with him, and I filmed him, you know, collecting this bamboo, and he, you know, held the bamboo in his hand, and he described the differences between the bamboo. He's like, this one is not straight enough. You cannot use this one. You have to use this one because it's straighter. I couldn't tell the difference. You know, I couldn't tell the difference between one bamboo and another, but he could. You know, that's how connected he is, you know, to the, you know, natural world around him, you know, and to the spiritual world. You know, the people, the indigenous people who live in the forest, they depend on the forest not only for their sustenance, but for their spiritual sustenance. You know, the netta, the spirits, they protect the forest. And once the forests are cut down, those spirits are gone. You know, they can't protect them anymore. You know, and so you wonder, you know, what will happen to a people who were not only materially disconnected, you know, from their land and their forests and their rivers, but also spiritually disconnected as well. You know, what will happen to them, not only physically, but also psychologically? You know, the change, the magnitude of the change is so quick and so fast. It's happening so quickly. Many of these people who have been living, you know, their way of life for centuries, you know, living in this way for centuries, in a way, they have to change their lives literally overnight. How does that impact a people spiritually and psychologically? You know, I can understand, you know, if we can, you know, if these changes are happening slowly, you know, over a period of 10, of 15 years, 20 years, 30 years, you know, the people are able to become educated and to understand what is happening to them, but they're not. They are completely uneducated and unaware of what is happening to them, but they are being displaced.
And ironically, too, at the end of the film, Q, who's a young woman who goes to Phnom Penh to work in the garment industry, and then she comes back home for at least a while, and you film her at home, and you film her saying that she wishes that all those rice fields the villagers work in would be converted into a factory.
Yeah, yeah. That moment really shocked me. You know, honestly, I mean, when I first heard her say that, I couldn't believe it, you know? You know, but I asked myself why. Why couldn't I believe it? And I realized I couldn't believe it because, you know, I come from a privileged Western background. I come from a privileged education. You know, I went to Yale University. I went to UCLA Law School. You know, I have a privileged life. And I understand the consequences of what would happen if a factory came to my village. I understand that. You know, Kyo doesn't. the only thing that she understands is what she wants, which is what everybody wants, Francesca. I mean, everybody wants a human and dignified life. Everybody wants electricity. Everybody wants infrastructure. Everybody wants education. Everybody wants health care. Everyone wants to be able to live next to their families. Mm-hmm. You know, Kiel wants the factory in her village because she doesn't want to leave her family. You know, instead of her going to the village, it makes sense. Have the factory come to her, and then she can stay and live with her family. But she doesn't understand the consequence of that. You know, she doesn't understand if the factory comes to her village, you know, there will be factory runoff. There will be effluent. There will be, you know, actually the government will come and take her land away from her to build that factory. And people will be displaced. And, you know, there will be environmental consequences, you know, to the factory being there. She doesn't realize that. She only wants what she wants, and which is completely understandable. And I think, you know, that the question for us is, how do we give her what she wants? How do we give everyone what they want? You know, everybody, even in China, even in Malaysia, Indonesia, in Colombia, in South America, in Mexico, you know, people are struggling to have what we have. Why can't they have that? But we need to balance those things. We need to find a balance between having those things, but also preserving the natural world, you know, that is so precious to us. When she said that, actually, and I thought about it a little bit more, I realized that, you know, we are all like frogs in a well. You know, Kyo, in her situation, she was like, she's like a frog in a well. And we, in our situation right now, we're like frogs in a well too. We still want many things. You know, we want, you know, our iPods, our iPads, our iPhones. You know, we want, you know, to drive, you know, our SUVs. You know, we want to, you know, have our big house and use as much electricity as we want. You know, we still want those things too. And we don't realize the consequences of that. You know, we actually, many of us don't realize that what we are doing right now is impacting the world and impacting the climate and impacting the environment. We don't realize that, but we continue to want, just like Hugh continues to want what she wants without realizing the consequences of her desires.
And the film is A River Changes Course, and we're talking with the filmmaker, Kalyani Mam. What's it going to take to give both Q and the others what they want, to bring their living standards up to an adequate basis while protecting the environment?
Yeah, there are actually projects that are being implemented in Cambodia, you know, by, you know, conservation organizations and by local people to, you know, preserve the forests and the land and to, you know, to prevent, you know, what is taking place and giving people alternatives to cutting down the forests, alternatives to even hunting, you know, for certain wildlife and certain animals. And, you know, I think those projects are really helpful, you know, to educate the local population as well about the importance of their environment and the importance of, you know, the natural world. I mean, they understand the importance because they live with it. But I think to understand it, the importance on an economic level is also another, you know, level of consciousness too. You know, because, you know, we don't only, the forest and the land is not only valued as something that is, you know, is beautiful and is part of the life and it gives us, you know, sustenance, but it also has an economic value that is recognized, you know, by the rest of the world, you know, and I think that level of consciousness really helps, you know, in preserving, you know, the land and the forest and their natural resources in Cambodia. There are other people too who are working on, you know, more sustainable tourism and, you know, giving the government an alternative to cutting down the forests, you know, and exploiting the land and the water. And saying, you know, if we preserve these forests, we'll have more opportunities for tourism, for ecotourism, you know. And so those efforts, I think, are really important as well. You know, so there's efforts on the conservation side, but there's also efforts on the side of prevention. There are people, there are organizations who are trying to prevent the government from actually allowing private companies to come and, you know, exploit the land. You know, so preventing them from giving land concessions, you know, and forced concessions to private companies to come and, you know, cut down the forest, you know, for example, you know, or come and fish in the waters during inappropriate times, you know. And so, you know, there are people who are, you know, fighting against all of this. And then there are the people themselves who have been already been removed, you know, from their land and their forests, and who are trying to, you know, get it back. And that's really the most difficult fight, you know, is getting the land back from these companies that, you know, have so much power and so much connection. It's literally impossible, you know. So I think the best thing that we can do is to try to prevent it from taking place, you know. And you know, this is what I'm trying to do in, you know, we are trying to do in trying to raise awareness about what is happening in Cambodia, you know, not only to the international community, but within Cambodia as well, because many people in Cambodia, you know, lack access to media and information. You know, they have no idea that what is happening to them is happening all over the country, you know. And so with that consciousness, I think that, you know, then people will be more willing to do something, you know, about what's happening. And people are protesting. Like I said, you know, earlier, they are protesting against what's happening. You know, but I think they need, you know, more assistance. They need more encouragement and more support. And I think the international community can do that. You know, and as for our campaign, you know, we are inviting people to help us, you know, screen the film, you know, all across the country, in Cambodia. But also screening the film here in the United States, you know, to help raise awareness. And we're trying to, you know, help raise funds to screen the film all across the country, because it takes, you know, funds, you know, resources to do that. But I really, I mean, I have hope in the future generation, Francesca. You know, I think that the future generation is where the answer lies, you know, because I know that the older generation, they're already set in their ways. But the younger generation, they are really passionate, you know, and they are aware. You know, they're using social media to communicate with one another. They're using Facebook, the power of Facebook, to communicate and organize, you know, protests, organize thoughts, organize, you know, the raising of consciousness, you know, which is what how we are communicating, you know, with the Cambodian population in Cambodia is actually through Facebook. You know, so I really have hope in the future generation to change things around, you know, because, you know, they want change to happen.
The film is A River Changes Course. We've been talking with the filmmaker Kalyani Mam. Go to Writer's Voice to see the trailer and to find out how you can bring the film to your campus or community. Next up, American Terroir and a conversation with Rowan Jacobson. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Ever since spending nearly a year living in a little village in southern France, I've been enamored of the idea of terroir, that special taste that place lends to local foods and wines. It's no accident that the notion has a French name, since the French are champions of terroir. In 1919, the French passed perhaps the first law protecting the place of origin for a given product. It's called AOC, Appellation. It covers things like wine, olive oil, and cheeses. Think, for example, of the Côte d'Aron label for wines. That covers a large region, but there are many AOCs that are much smaller. There's even one that covers only 10 acres of land. But you don't have to be French to appreciate the terroir of local foods and wines. My guest, Rowan Jacobson, has written a wonderful guide to American terroir. Part travelogue, part resource guide, and with recipes to match, Jacobson takes the eager locavore on a tour of regional specialties. Apples from Washington, maple syrup from Vermont, a smorgasbord of honey flavors from all different regions, and much more in his book, American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields. Jacobson answers the question of why place matters. Why, for example, honey from the banks of the Apalachicola River tastes like cinnamon, and why many of the country's most intense cheeses are created in one underground cave in Vermont. Rowan Jacobson writes about food, the environment, and the connections between the two. His work has appeared in The Art of Eating, The New York Times, Outside Magazine, Harper's, and elsewhere. American Terroir was published in 2010 by Bloomsbury. Tell us first, what is terroir and what it isn't?
Yeah, well, that's an excellent question. And depending on who you ask, you will get different answers. But as generally understood, terroir often gets translated as the taste of place. And it's about how the influences of an environment, of a particular place, show up in the taste of a food or a drink. So in France, it gets used to refer to various foods, but usually you hear it in association with wine. And it's a big part of understanding the character of a wine in France is understanding its terroir, the place that it comes from, and how that place changes the taste of the wine. But where you get into some interesting arguments is, you know, what you count as factors in terroir. Is it just the soil? Is it just the things that the dirt is doing to the grapes or to whatever other food is being grown? Or do you include the climate and the decisions made by the people who are growing food along the way?
And so what do you think?
I wrestled with this concept while working on the book. And what really defines terroir to me is it doesn't have to just be what you might call the chemical definition of terroir, like the different compounds in the earth that are affecting flavor, but anything that a place on earth is doing that is giving a cue to the plant itself or to the people growing the plant about what they should be doing to draw out the greatest flavor possible should count as terroir. So definitely the weather is a big factor in terroir. But if you look at France, the grapes that are now associated with particular regions were chosen over thousands of years of trial and error because they worked for that place because of the type of soil and the type of climate that that place had. So I feel like those types of decisions made by people are an important part of terroir.
Now, you mean this book, American Terroir, as a kind of sampler, and it gives us gives the reader a wonderful combination of a kind of travelogue, a resource guide, and even some recipes that I can't wait to try out. These are all recipes that you've tried out?
Oh, yeah. I had to test them all.
It must have been a lot of fun to do this book. Let's start. You start with breakfast. You kind of go around through the day, and we start with breakfast with maple syrup. You point out that maple sugaring really can't be industrialized. It has to be done by small local producers. Why is that?
Maple sugar comes from maple sap, which is what's found in maple trees, and only during a very, very brief time of the year is it possible to get the sap that makes good syrup. And that's that first little stretch of late winter, early spring, when the temperature is warm. It's at that point that the maple trees start, that the sap starts flowing through the maple trees. So you need a lot of maple trees to make any significant quantity of maple syrup. The number I usually see is that each tap on a tree will produce about a quart of maple syrup at best. So you need hundreds or thousands of trees just to make a few hundred gallons of maple syrup. So it doesn't work on a large scale level because there just aren't maple forests. In order to be an industrial maple syrup maker, you'd have to own a maple forest the size of Vermont. Every 40 gallons of sap makes 1 gallon of maple syrup, because what you have to do is you take that sap, which only has 2 to 3% sugar in it, and then you boil it for hour after hour to get it down into that syrup. So it's incredibly energy intensive and labor intensive. So it's something that can only really be a labor of love. Like, no company in its right mind would decide to go into maple syrup.
Now, you call it the Church of the North Woods, these wonderful sugar shacks, and I know them well. I used to live right down the road from one of these, and, you know, as you point out, they only operate, you know, at a very short period of the year. You went and you talked to one of the finest producers you found, Craig Line. He's a photographer by trade, but he also produces some of the best maple syrup. Tell us about him.
He's a great photographer, and he built a beautiful sugar shack not too far from my house, about maybe 5 miles away. And as I talk about in the book, it's just one of my favorite feelings in early spring is when the sugaring season starts and the sap starts to run. What happens is, you know, it's been cold winter in Vermont, and you've kind of been bundled up all winter, and everything is just white and still kind of dead outside. And there's, like, if looking around the landscape, you wouldn't see any signs that spring had started to stir. But there's invisible things that are happening, like the sap running in the maple trees. So you'll be driving along, and these sugar houses are like, they're kind of like the size of garages usually, but with peaked roofs and little cupolas on top that open up to let the steam out, because when you're boiling sap for hours, you make a hell of a lot of steam, so you got to let it out somehow. So you'll just be driving along your car, and then you'll see one of these sugar shacks with just an incredible amount of steam coming out the top of it and rising to the sky. And you know that's a sign that somebody's making syrup in there. And so there'll be lots of neighborhood parties, but even if there isn't one, you're usually, kind of the unwritten law is that you're welcome to stop by, and there'll be somebody in there, and you walk in, and it's almost like you walk into the rainforest, because you go from this cold, wintry world and into this little area that has like a 80% humidity level, and is hot, and there's this bubbling syrup going, and people are handing out shots of syrup straight up and mixing them with bourbon sometimes, and it's just a wonderful kind of communal atmosphere that is that first crop of the year.
And there are many flavors, many different flavors. I mean, not only the different flavors that come at different times, as you point out, the earliest is the clearest, fine quality, all the way down to the dark, which isn't any worse in quality, it's just later in the year and darker. But what makes the different flavors of maple syrup that comes from different places?
The taste of maple partly has to do with what time in the year you make it. And as you say, it gets darker and more intense as you go. So at first you have like a light caramel flavor, and then it gets much kind of smokier and more molasses like toward the end, and almost a little bit bacony sometimes. But then also, and this is something that the industry in Vermont is really just starting to understand and explore, the landscape will affect that flavor a lot. The type of bedrock that the trees are growing on, whether it's like schist or limestone, can actually have a big effect. And also whether the trees are growing down in, say, the Champlain Valley, where they kind of have richer soil to work with, or whether they're growing on top of a mountain where they've got really rocky soil. And one thing that I noticed is that the sugar bushes found on rocky mountaintops, this again goes back to that stress thing we talked about, they really they have a much harder time making sugar than trees in more comfortable environments. So their sugar level is actually lower. But then when you have to boil it more to get it to the 68% sugar level of maple syrup, you are then concentrating everything else that's in them that much more. So you get a lot more of the secondary compounds that contribute to that sort of wild maple flavor.
And that's one of the reasons you say that Craig Line's maple syrup. And what's the name of his company again?
He just usually goes by his name, Craig Line. There's another one called Dragonfly Sugar Works
that
I talk about.
Dragonfly Sugar.
Yeah, Dragonfly Sugar Works, which is made by a guy named Paul Limberty. which is another a great syrup. And he's got a website, Dragonfly Sugar Works, and also sells at the Burlington, Vermont Farmers Market.
And his is kind of, his land, the trees are growing on a pretty steep slopes. And you say that's what you've just been talking about, the fact that they are more stressed is one of the reasons why you think his maple sugar is so good.
Yeah, definitely. It's got more of those secondary flavor compounds in it.
Climate change will eventually affect maple sugar production in New England. At the least, it will move maple forests up mountain slopes and further north. But Rowan Jacobson sees a more immediate threat: forests cut down by developers, loss of maple habitat.
The biggest challenge is just having forests of maple trees. So global warming is definitely an issue, but just loss of habitat is a bigger issue. And that's actually one of the amazing things about maple syrup is that it's a big part of the reason Vermont still has 85% forests, because it kind of helps forests pay for themselves. Like, if you can at least pay off your taxes and make a little bit of money from your forest through maple syrup, then you're less likely to cut it down and sell it off as lots.
Yeah, in fact, you say this whole concept of terroir is a way that connects us with the land and also then connects us with preserving it. And it gives consumers also a reason, you know, foodie consumers a reason to preserve habitat.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I feel like it's a way to value landscapes. Everything, basically, we live in a culture where everything comes down to a dollar figure. Like, that's how we know to evaluate value. And if people understand the amazing and unique things that a particular landscape can produce, and they come to value that, then that literally adds value to that landscape, and it's less likely to get converted into other things that we have a more traditional way of valuing, like home lots or, you know, building sites.
We're speaking with Rowan Jacobson about his new book, American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields. And it's a wonderful read. Also, just beautifully written as well, as having just packed with good, flavorful information. Let's talk about apples. Here's also something that is grown in New England, but you went actually to the Yakima Valley of Washington State for apples. Why did you go there?
Washington State is our biggest grower of apples. Like, we tend to think of New England as being like perfect place for apples, and a lot of ways it is, but we can't compare with Washington State in terms of how easy it is to grow apples out there. Like, we have a very wet climate compared to the Yakima Valley, and so our apples tend to have a lot of scab on them and tend to get mildew issues and tend to have a lot of pests unless we use chemicals to stop that. But in the Yakima Valley is basically a desert. It gets something like 4 inches of precipitation a year, basically none. It's always sunny out there. And you could never normally grow an apple tree out there. An apple tree likes a fair amount of water, but it's all irrigated out there. So this is sort of an interesting spin on terroir, where sometimes people interpret terroir as you know, saying like no interference, right? Just let the landscape do what it can do. But here's a situation where they're using irrigation to do something the landscape never could have done, and to do something that we could never do here in New England, because when you give those trees all the water they need through irrigation, and they're getting sun all the time, and there's almost no impact of pests or fungi out there because it's so dry, you can get these organic apples that are just perfect and that grow incredibly easily, and also that really benefit from the huge diurnal swings in temperature, where you got hot days and cold nights. Because a cold night is the signal to an apple tree to start to pump sugar into the fruit, because cold means fall is coming. So an apple tree will be sweeter if it gets cold nights and if it gets a lot of sun, because, of course, it uses that sun through photosynthesis to make the sugar in the first place. It'll also be redder, because the redness in apple skin is actually a form of natural sunscreen that it makes. So it's like just these dreamy apples, huge, perfect apples that come off the trees out there. And it's almost unfair to us, because, you know, we could never grow an apple like that. And you could also argue that our apples are going to have more interesting and varied flavors because of their, you know, their tough, hard-knock life here in New England. But it is pretty impressive to be out there and just see these, you know, red jewels on the trees.
And you point out that there used to be many, many more varieties than there are now. We almost went down to just a few, you know, Red Delicious and, you know, just a couple of others with the industrialized agriculture. But now organic apples are really gaining ground and we're getting different varieties of them. Talk a little bit about the varieties that are coming onto the market.
Yeah, it's a really hopeful time in the apple world. After this incredible loss of diversity from thousands of varieties, or even like 10,000 varieties to just maybe 100 varieties, and just a handful that were grown commercially, people really seem to have finally come around to appreciating diversity of flavor, which is something that, you know, you almost can't overemphasize what a surprising shift this was in the American palate after so long heading in the direction of industrialization and monoculture to suddenly be interested in diversity in terms of flavor. And New England is really just a genetic gold mine in terms of reviving the apple because, you know, as anyone knows who's driven around back dirt roads in New England, there are just apple trees growing all over the place. And every one of those is a potential for a new species because those wild apple trees are often formed from mothers and fathers that were abandoned varieties. So there's all this wild and crazy apple DNA lurking on the back roads of New England. And people are also learning to develop new varieties of apples that have much more interesting flavors than most of the ones that we grew up with, like the Red Delicious and the Golden Delicious. So you're getting apples like the Ambrosia and the Honeycrisp now, which have a lot of sweetness to them, but also a lot of acidity and a lot of crispness to them. They actually have smaller cells than a lot of the other apples like Red Delicious that have big cells that lead to kind of a mushy texture.
Another thing that has many different varieties is honey. And I just love this chapter, Rowan Jacobson, in your book, American Terroir. You point out, you know, this is something I really didn't know. I've seen wildflower honey, of course, and clover honey and sage honey. And I just always assumed that honey is honey is honey and all would taste pretty much the same. But you say not at all. Talk about some of the different flavors.
Yeah, boy, honeys can be all over the place, more so than almost any other food. And it all has to do with what the source of the honey is, because to make honey, bees visit flowers, and they get the nectar, which is basically sugar water from the flowers. Then they take it back to their hive and condense it into a syrup, which is what honey is. So really, honey is as diverse as fruit is, because every single flower is going to have its own special mix of nectar that it makes. And those nectars all taste very different from each other. So if you taste, say, a chestnut honey, which is made from chestnut flowers, or versus an orange blossom honey, and then a clover honey, they're all going to be very different from each other. And we tend to, if you grew up with a little squeeze bear from the store, that was pretty much the mildest honey that could be had because the goal was to make a very, bland product that could be the same everywhere. But first thing I do when I go to a town I haven't been to before is I try to find the farmer's market and buy some local honeys because it'll kind of give you a really fun, immediate clue as to what that landscape is like and what some of the interesting things are that grow just there.
And not too far from Western Massachusetts is a place where you can sample honeys from all over the country and the world. You went to visit the Red Queen. Tell us about her. And the time that you had there tasting the different honeys that she had.
That's a woman named Marina Marchese. And she doesn't have a retail shop, but she sells online and sells to a lot of stores in New York and elsewhere. So, you can order her honeys online. She usually has 20 or 30 varieties. And she gets them from all over. She gets some very interesting varieties. She's got some orange blossoms. Some are local New England honeys. and some are from much further afield. Tupelo is a really fascinating honey that she'll have, and you can also find it elsewhere. It's kind of a famous honey. You know, made Van Morrison helped make it famous, but it was already famous before that as a very particular honey from the southeast that would never crystallize like some honeys can do. And it's only made from the Tupelo tree, which is a tree that grows in the swamps in the Florida panhandle. I was actually just down there a couple of weeks ago visiting a man who makes maybe the only 100% Tupelo honey in the world by taking a barge up the Apalachicola River in Florida and unloading his hives in these swamps. You can't drive to these places because it's so wet, but he has these little docks set up in the swamps, and he just takes all the hives up, puts them on the docks during the Tupelo bloom, and so gets this honey that is made from nothing but Tupelo flowers, because that's the only thing that the bees can find in these swamps.
Oh, do tell. Who is this?
His name is George Watkins, and you can find his honey online, too. It's amazing, amazing honey.
You say that some of the best honey you ever tasted was from Tokyo.
Yeah, which I hadn't expected. I was over there on a book tour, and it turns out there's something called the Ginza Honey Project, which makes honey right in downtown Tokyo. Ginza is kind of that center section of Tokyo. And the honeybees, I think, are mostly... Bees can actually do quite well in urban environments, and you're seeing a big revival of beekeeping in places like New York City, because there's usually people are growing a lot of flowers, and so the bees have lots of sources of nectar. And usually there actually aren't that many pesticides used in truly urban environments. So bees can do well there. And the ones in Tokyo were doing really well. And I actually think they were getting a lot of their nectar from the Emperor's Palace, which is right in downtown Tokyo also, and is this huge natural area with lots and lots of gardens for the bees to choose from. So it was this beautiful light honey made right in downtown Tokyo.
Oh, that's marvelous. You actually, though, say that the honey made in the U.S. is some of the tastiest. Tell us about cat claw honey. Where is this from?
Yeah, this one. That's one of it. There's a number of desert honeys that come from the Southwest that have really unusual flavors. Some good, some bad. There's a mesquite honey that's really good. There's cat claw. There's certain towns down there that have very strong honey traditions, and you don't really learn about them in the rest of the country. But, you know, they'll be locally famous for these honeys that are a unique product on Earth because they'll be working with some, you know, wild shrub like the cat claw that just has its own flavor. And to me, it's just like a really, really special and undervalued food that is the kind of thing that if you didn't pay attention to and that whole area got turned into subdivisions, it would be a great loss and not enough people would notice.
And we could not end this interview without talking about cheese. You're up in Vermont. You talk about the washed rind cheese of Vermont. Tell us about that, and tell us, how do you make milk rot right?
Glad you asked. cheese is basically rotten milk, but it's got to be the right kind of rotten milk. The age-old way of making cheese is to take the milk, get a lot of the water out of it by curdling it, and then you've got basically what's like fresh farmer's cheese, and then you just let it start to decay. And there are zillions of microscopic organisms in the air that will help take care of that process for you, but you wouldn't want just anyone to do it. There are certain ones that make it decay nicely and certain ones that don't. So what cheesemakers have always learned to do is to either add the correct organisms to the fresh cheese to age it, or to just set the conditions so that the right natural organisms will age it for you. And that's what happens with washed rind cheese, is the cheesemakers take like a brine and wash the cheese in this brine so it's got a really salty surface. And there are only certain organisms that can survive that salty surface. And one of them is the type of bacteria responsible for making stinky cheese. And it's perfectly safe to eat, but it's definitely stinky. So by washing the rind all the time, the cheesemakers encourage this sort of bright orange bacteria to grow on the rind, and that's what gives some of those super strong cheeses like Münster its characteristic flavor. And there's a cheesemaker I'm quite fond of here in Vermont who does that using the these natural bacteria that are in the air. And also, instead of just using a plain brine, they actually use a salted beer that their neighbor makes. So that adds another little extra bit of unique local terroir to the flavor of the cheese.
And that's Matteo Kaler?
Yeah, he's a cheesemaker, and it's called Jasper Hill Farms.
Yeah, they've gotten a lot of praise from, I don't know if it was best in show, but pretty high up there in cheese competitions.
Yeah, they've won quite a few, and yeah, they've become a big deal. They actually have these amazing aging facilities that are built right into a hillside here in Vermont, and they make maybe six or seven different fantastic cheeses. Now, they also work with a lot of small farms in Vermont and New Hampshire, because part of their mission isn't just to make great cheese, but to keep these working rural landscapes alive by giving these small farmers a way to support themselves.
In your book, American Terroir, you also talk about chocolate and wine and mushrooms and coffee. We don't really have the time right now to talk about those, but I wanted to ask you, you ranged all over North America. You went to Canada. You went down to parts of Central America even. What's the most important thing you learned while doing this book?
To try to not approach a food with like preconceptions. We tend to learn only one style of a particular food, and then we think that's how that food is supposed to be. And usually that food is made in all kinds of different ways all over the world, in ways that are totally interesting and valid, but don't get much attention because they don't fit into the specs that have been created for that food. So that's one thing I learned, is that there's a much wider variety of flavors out there than we think there are.
Well, this was a delicious book, American Terroir, Savoring the Flavors of Our Woods, Waters, and Fields. It's got recipes, it's got resources. It's a wonderful book to read. And thank you so much, Rowan Jacobson, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks, Francesca. It's been a pleasure.
Rowan Jacobson is also the author of A Geography of Oysters, The Connoisseur's Guide to Oyster Eating in North America, Fruitless Fall, The Collapse of the Honeybee and the Coming Agricultural Crisis, and The Living Shore. His work has been included in the Best American Science and Nature Writing and Best Food Writing collections. American Terroir was named as one of the top 10 books of the year by Library Journal in 2010. His latest book is Shadows on the Gulf, A Journey Through Our Last Great Wetland. Go to writersvoice.net for links to some of Rowan Jacobson's articles. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.